All right, good afternoon, everybody. It is Thursday, 12:40, and it is February 4th. So we're gonna be doing free radical reactions, and hopefully, I think you can just see my screen share at this point. And just to check in, I've got one student who is experiencing issues with the video recordings that I put online. But I haven't heard any other issues from anybody. I'm just curious if anybody ran into any issues with looking at those videos online for the lab or any of the other videos. Everything seems to be running okay. All right, I'll keep working with that one student. I think what I'm gonna do is take some of the videos and upload them onto YouTube and make them accessible there. And maybe that will help with some people's streaming. If they're streaming from YouTube, then YouTube handles the streaming and they reformat them all. So I'll give that a shot too. But sounds like for most people, sounds like everything is going okay so far. And that's good, that's what we want. All right, so we're moving out of the chapter on alkynes and moving into free radicals. And the progression is that we go free radicals, then we have a short synthesis chapter, then we go into alcohols, and after alcohols, we go into thiols and some other things before we get into spectroscopy. And it really is after we finish this free radical chapter that we can start synthesis, because we could do some small synthesis projects right now. We have some interesting sorts of chemistry that we can do, but it's very hard to functionalize a molecule which has no functional groups on it. So if you start from a basic alkane, the only way to functionalize that alkane is through free radical chemistry, which is why we introduced this free radical chemistry chapter right before we do the synthesis. So that's where everything sort of clicks in and fits in. So in order to do the free radical chapter, we need to understand first the different types of bond fragmentations. So the context of this is that we're looking at different types of ways of functionalizing unfunctionalized molecules. And it's just going to give us some unique reactions that we can do. Okay, so if we have a bond and we have X and Y, what we have looked at to date is this sort of fragmenting of the bond and the electrons going one direction. When they go one direction like this, this is usually caused by heat, and we end up with ions, both a cation and an anion. And the reason that that guy gets the anion is because it has the lone pairs. So this is what is called heterolytic cleavage. It's asymmetric, meaning that the electrons are going to one side. The other way in which a bond can fragment is homolytically, meaning consistently evenly. So here the bond splits in the middle and one electron goes one way and one electron goes the other way. In this case, what we create is two free radicals. And so that's the type of reaction that we're going to be looking at right now. And if you notice the arrow difference, I've changed the way that I'm handling my arrows. My arrows so far have been double-ended arrows. This is the movement of two electrons. But when I do a free radical, and it's a single electron, I do a fishhook arrow. And it implies the movement of one electron. And so the arrows that I actually use are different as I go through and start doing this type of chemistry. And you'll see that we'll change the usage of how we're doing the arrows. Okay. Now, the next thing to know when we're starting to look at free radicals is the structure of a free radical. And we have some choices. So the question is, what does a free radical look like? So far, what we have is we have carbocations. So let's look at a carbocation. The carbocations are trigonal planar. They have the empty p orbital. And so we've got the bond angles of 120 degrees. And with carbanions, what we have is we have something which is tetrahedral. And that orbital is an sp3 hybrid orbital that the electrons sit in. And that constitutes the negative charge. And this orbital is a p orbital. So we have the differences in the orbitals and the differences in the hybridizations. We would say that this one is sp2 and that this one is sp3. So then the question is, well, what does a free radical look like? Does a free radical look more like a carbocation or does a free radical look more like a carbanion? And so this is our, let's style this in a different color here, because this is our question. Now, which is it? Is it more carbocation-like or is it more free radical-like? And the nature of what a free radical looks like, whether it's more carbocation-like or more carbanion-like, changes how we think about it. And what we find is that when we look at these, that they're actually sp2 hybridized and they're carbocation-like. So free radicals are carbocation-like. And they're not carbanion-like. So we don't see them appearing in this way. And that is actually extremely helpful. Because they're carbocation-like, it turns out that they have all the same stability factors as carbocations. So free radicals are very similar to carbocations and have all the same stability factors. So with a few very minor exceptions, everything that you know about carbocations directly translates to free radicals. So that's important. Everything that you did with resonance, everything that you did with electron donating, electron drawing groups, all of that directly translates to free radicals. And so, you know, one of the things that we knew was that when we looked at carbocations, we could go from a primary carbocation to a secondary carbocation to a tertiary carbocation, and that these guys were increasing in stability. We could say that this is more stable in terms of the way that we're increasing from primary to secondary to tertiary. Well, the same is exactly true of free radicals, that when we look at the free radicals, the stability of the free radicals follows exactly the stability of the carbocations, and for the exact same reasons. The reasons were that we were increasing the number of electron donating groups. So that if we look at the number of electron donating groups that are flanking the carbocation, it is the same number of electron donating groups that are flanking the free radical that are increasing the stability of the free radical because they're donating electron density to it. So you need to think of a free radical as being electron deficient and is stabilized by the same things as carbocations. All right, so the teaching is always building on what we know and modeling after what we know, so we don't have to put in so much cognitive work to try to memorize everything. Okay, so from here, let's take a look at some of the resonance factors and how resonance plays a role. Because while resonance is important with free radicals, it's a little bit different in the way that we draw it. So let's remind ourselves how we would draw resonance for a carbocation. We would simply take and shift the two electrons over in order to draw the resonance contributor, placing the positive charge on the opposite end. When we do a free radical and an allylic free radical, we do essentially the same thing, except the bond must fragment homolytically and the electrons must come together and be done individually. And so we're moving each individual electron in the bond. And so it requires many more lines in order to represent the new structure. So this one required a single arrow. These require many more. One for each electron. And they're fishhook arrows, so they're only half-sided arrows, okay? And we have some really stable things to think about, or let me put it this way. There were some very stable carbocations due to resonance. This was a benzylic carbocation. Benzylic carbocations were very stable due to resonance. Same sort of thing. This is a benzylic radical. In the same way that benzylic carbocations are really stable, benzylic radicals are very stable, also due to their resonance. Okay. There's something else here that I needed to do that I need to be careful of. We saw some of these carbocations. This is an SP carbocation. We saw some of these carbocations from the alkyne chapter. When we did things like hydrate and alkyne, we might get some of these types of carbocations. This type of carbocation has no resonance. There's no way to take the double bond and to push it into the positive charge because the positive charge resides on the same carbon with the double bond. So there's no resonance for this type. In the same way, there is no resonance for an SP free radical. So we can make these types of things, and they're both SP hybridized and they're both linear. They're both 180 degree bond angle. Neither one of them has resonance for that type of structure, okay? As we start getting into reactions with free radicals, it's important to understand that there are certain patterns, reaction patterns, just like there were reaction patterns where we saw SN2 and E2 and SN1 and E1, that there were certain reaction patterns that we needed to recognize. There are reaction patterns that we need to recognize with free radicals as well, but these are smaller, these are individual steps. So these are common patterns or common steps within free radical mechanisms. Okay, so within these, number one, no hydride or alkyl shifts. Unlike carbocations, in a carbocation, sometimes we get hydride shifts in order to be able to get to a more stable carbocation. So we would go from something that is secondary to something that is tertiary. But free radicals, if we have a secondary free radical, there's no shift. Nothing happens. It will stay secondary rather than having something like a hydrogen migrate. Okay, so no shifts occur.
Jason, so there's no shifts, but like, will there be intramolecular reactions sometimes if there's a double bond elsewhere in the molecule?
There are certainly intermolecular reactions. For instance, it is common to see things like this occur, that if I have a free radical on an oxygen like this, that free radical can abstract a proton and other bonds can break and things can happen in the molecule intermolecularly that allow for chemical reactions to take place within the molecule. So there aren't shifts like hydride shifts, but we do see chemical reactions that result when the molecule can align correctly in order to allow sort of like acid-base reactions within free radicals to happen. So, but that's different, Sterling. That's a completely different sort of chemical reactivity. It's not considered a shift. It's considered something else. So let's just ignore for now. The first step that we look at, or the first type of reaction pattern, is called a homolytic cleavage. These are initiation steps. Oftentimes, free radical reactions are chain reactions. They continue to go once they've been initiated. This is an initiation step. Usually we have some molecule that for whatever reason gets struck by energy, a photon. And in being struck by that photon, it fragments the bond. One electron going to each direction. And as such, what we create are two of the free radicals. So this is a homolytic cleavage, an initiation step. And we would say that this can be done either by heat or by light. So those are the two symbols, one that we use for heat. This is delta equals heat. Usually implies that you're heating strongly, that you're at the boiling point of a solvent. The other symbol is the lambda nu. Lambda nu is the symbols for wavelength and frequency, and together, multiplied together, these equal the speed of light. And so these are symbols that we oftentimes use for light. Okay, number three is addition to pi bond.
Jason?
Yeah.
Just to clarify, the superscript on the X, that's a dot and not a zero, correct?
It is a dot and not a zero. It represents the single electron as opposed to a lone pair of electrons.
Okay, thank
you. So actually, I wouldn't even think of it. Let's not think of it as a superscript. Let's think of it as, you know how we do Lewis structures, Lewis dot structures, and we consider the element to be boxed in and two electrons on a side so that we get up to eight electrons, and that's where we get our octet. So it's a quick way of doing Lewis structures. Well, what we're doing is we're simply just getting rid of all but one of the electrons. And so it's just a representation of the single lone electron. Okay, addition to pi bonds. In addition to pi bonds, what we have is a free radical, which breaks the pi bond by joining the two electrons, and then this electron goes back in that direction. So this is an addition where I create a new bond. I guess I can use red to create the new bond. And the free radical is the, even though my free radicals may look open, they're dots. And so we're looking at the location of the free radical. Okay. And we'll cover these in more detail, but just as we add that free radical to a double bond, remember that there's two ways in which it could add. It could add to the left or it could add to the right. So I could just as easily create this situation where the new bond is here. And so if we're numbering those carbons and we're saying that this is 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3, then this one is the major one. And it's because it's more stable secondary free radical. Exactly the same as the carbocation. So we're making all the same decision-making processes. We're not introducing anything new. All right, number four is hydrogen abstraction. Hydrogen abstraction is nothing more than acid base in the free radical world. So here what we have is we have a free radical. We have a proton, which is bound to something. And in our abstraction, we take the proton away by fragmenting the bond homolytically. We create XH and R radical. So it's just an acid base, but looking at it from a free radical reaction sense. How are we doing? You guys keeping up? Okay. Next one is halogen abstraction. So this is number five. Now, we don't have an equivalent of this in the standard chemistry that we've looked at, because it doesn't seem like you should be able to do this. But because of the way that free radicals work, they can abstract halogens just as easily as they can abstract protons. They work in a very similar way. So what we have is we have a free radical, which might be on a carbon, and we have a halogen, which is on some other molecule. And the abstraction looks just like the acid base abstraction. We split the bond homolytically. I'm going to put a prime on that R group so that it looks different. And so that's our halogen abstraction. Quite common in free radical reactions. 6 is elimination. So in an elimination reaction, what we have is the free radical in this reaction, the radical pushes in, the bond breaks, electrons come over to join it, and that guy takes its one electron with it. So this becomes X radical, and we get the double bond. I'm going to put one more bond in here, an easy fix for you guys to keep up with, just because it makes it look just makes it easier to follow. Sometimes if you have just ethylene doesn't look good on a page by itself in terms of looking back at your notes and going, what the heck is that? Why did I draw an equal sign? So throwing another carbon in there makes it a little bit easier to track. Okay. This is very common to have as well, these elimination reactions. And then the last one is a coupling or termination reaction. These are not as common. So in a termination reaction, what happens is generally it's not halogens, generally it's R groups. We have two free radicals and the two free radicals will find each other and they will bring their electrons together in order to join to make a new bond. And so we get a bond between the two R groups. And if you look at every other reaction, all of these reactions, starting from the initiation, the reaction propagates, makes a free radical. The reaction of a free radical with a double bond makes a free radical. The abstraction of a proton makes a free radical. The halogen abstraction makes a free radical. The elimination makes a free radical. The coupling termination, no free radical. That's why this is called a termination component, because it ends the free radical reaction. It stops the cycle and the propagation of free radicals. So every time a free radical reacts, unless it reacts with another free radical, it always makes a free radical. So it is another way, JC, to make carbon-carbon bonds, but not a great way. It's it is a way that we do actually, great question. This is propylene. Propylene, I didn't spell that right. There's no Y in there. E-N-E, propylene. And if you hit this with free radicals, or we start it off with light and heat, what we make is we make a polymer. Wherein the propylene is sitting here. So if we take these carbons and we say that this is carbon 1, 2, and 3, this becomes carbon 1, 2, and 3. This is our repeat unit. And our repeat unit is here. And what we make are we're making new bonds. And this continues. And this is called polypropylene. Yenny, still not spelling it right, but I'm close enough. Okay, so yes, we can make new carbon-carbon bonds through all sorts of polymerizations. And the process is that it makes a free radical, it splits the bond homolytically and makes a free radical. Usually there's an initiator besides this that has to start this. But basically what winds up happening is, let's say that we have an initiator that winds up binding to our material that has the free radical in it. And then as the next double bond comes up, it reacts with that double bond in order to make a new bond. And so there's our new bond and the molecule that we've connected to, and the next one, and then they just keep linking up. So these reactions can just go on and make very, very long chains, millions of these all linked together, making great big long ropes. And just like if you take ropes or extension cords and you throw them into the dryer and you mix them up, you try to pull out a single rope, it comes out with the entire ball because they're all tangled together, even though they're not bound together. Even though you may have 10 ropes, trying to get a single rope out of the dryer without pulling all 10 out is almost impossible. Polymers are exactly the same way. They're not cross-linked, but they make a solid and they're all bound together because of their twisted and turning nature and how they are all intertwined. So yes, we can make carbon-carbon bonds this way, but it's a little bit hard to control. Okay, so the first reaction that I want to look at besides polymerization, aside from that, the carbon-carbon one got me distracted, is simple chlorination. So in chlorination, what we do, the reaction looks like this, CH4 with chlorine gas exposed to light, and the products that we get out of it are CH3Cl and HCl. And the mechanism starts off with the chlorine bond being fragmented by the light. That splits our bond in half, homolytically cleaving the chlorine. That produces chlorine-free radicals. The chlorine-free radical then abstracts a proton. And we get the abstraction part, sort of the acid-base reaction. That makes the carbon radical. The carbon radical then is sp2 hybridized. So we'll draw it appropriately. And that carbon radical reacts with another molecule of chlorine. See, the amount of chlorine-free radical that we make is very small in the overall reaction scheme. And so the likelihood of this molecule, the carbon radical, finding another chlorine radical is very low. However, the probability of the free radical carbon finding a chlorine molecule is fairly high. And so usually these reactions propagate in this way. Where we split that bond again, and we lead to the new carbon-chlorine bond. And the other piece out of this is a chlorine radical. That chlorine radical then picks up another methyl, and the whole thing keeps going in a cycle.
Jason?
Yeah.
Is this number 8 on our common patterns, or is this an example?
This is actually an example of chlorination, but what we can do is we can put names to each one of these steps. So what we're getting is we're getting the homolytic cleavage. So this would be number 2. Then we're getting, I don't know, what is proton extraction? Is that number 3? No, it's number 4. So this is number 4. This is proton abstraction. Number five would be halogen abstraction is the way, well, it is sort of halogen abstraction. It's not addition to double bond. I'd really say it's more like halogen abstraction. And that was six. I'll make sure. Seven, five. So this is five. Halogen abstraction. And then the next step would go back to proton abstraction. And then halogen abstraction, proton abstraction, halogen abstraction, and we just go around in the ring until one free radical finds another and we get the elimination or the termination step. So this is a chain reaction. And it's hard to stop once it starts. And in fact, what we find is that halogenation doesn't happen just once. What we find is that CH4, when it reacts with chlorine, with light, and it produces CH3Cl, that reacts with chlorine and light, and that produces CH2Cl2. And each time, the molecule gets slightly more reactive towards this reaction, such that it's hard to stop it, and it just keeps going. So we make chloromethane. We make dichloromethane. We make chloroform. And carbon tetrachloride. And so the reaction just keeps on going. And they become more reactive upon substitution. So that means that dichloromethane is more reactive to this reaction than is chloromethane. Chloroform is even more reactive than dichloromethane. So the reaction gets stronger with more substitution.
Does it get more stable because, like, basically your reactant is the carbon something chloride and then the chlorine free radical? So making the radical the carbon based thing makes the radical that forms more stable?
If we take a look at what the chlorine is doing, the chlorine allows for resonance with the lone pair or with the free radical. And so I can get a resonance contributor whereby I can push the electrons in its resonance, so I need double-ended arrow. And the chlorine helps to stabilize. And so if we take a look at how many electrons the chlorine has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Seven valence electrons, it comes with seven. So this is still neutral, this is still zero charge. But when you take a look at the octet rule, it has 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. But remember, not 10, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. Chlorine, because it's in period three in the periodic table and it has d orbitals, it can utilize those d orbitals to have higher than an octet number of electrons. And so the resonance capability with a chlorine, because chlorine can expand its octets and go to 10, 12, and even 14 electron rules, chlorine can do this resonance without a problem and helps to stabilize. And so with more chlorines, we simply get more resonance. So that's where that comes from. That's why it becomes more stable. Okay, radical initiators. How do we start some of these reactions? There are some molecules that we use as radical initiators that fragment very easily. And you should be familiar with these because you'll see them quite frequently used throughout, throughout this chapter and subsequent chapters. And actually, you've seen some of these and not known why you've seen some of these or not known how they react. So the first one is halogens, like chlorine. Chlorine can be fragmented with heat or light, does not take very much. You end up with the two chlorine free radicals, and the heat of formation of these is equal to 243 kilojoules per mole. Basically, what we're tracking is the higher the number of kilojoules per mole, the harder it is to break the molecule apart. Organoperoxides. You've used these before when we've done things like HBr and peroxide. We never told you why the peroxide actually did what it did, or at least in my class, we talked about it, but we said that the reaction mechanism changed to a free radical one. Well, how does it change to a free radical one? It's because peroxide is a free radical initiator. So what happens here is that heat or light will fragment the radical bond, the peroxide bond. That's the word I'm looking for. Sometimes you just got to get around to the right word, get the tongue going where it's supposed to go. This is done with heat or light. And it forms two oxygen-free radicals. This is easier to do. It's 159 kilojoules per mole. Acyl peroxides. This you haven't seen yet. But an acyl peroxide is a molecule that is formed from two carboxylic acids. And it's a peroxy acid, is what it is. And the acyl peroxides do the same sort of thing. They fragment homolytically. And I would ask why these are more stable. So we get two of these guys. And the heat of formation is 121 kilojoules per mole. These numbers, by the way, that I'm throwing out are not important to memorize. I'm simply throwing them out to show you how these are increasing in stability as we go forward, right? So why is it that an acyl free radical is more stable than an alcohol free radical? And it goes back to the exact same reason that, yeah, Stirling's got it, that an alcohol is less acidic than a carboxylic acid. It's because of the resonance and the stability that is created through resonance for the acyl group, for the carboxyl group. Okay, last one that we do is a larger molecule. This is a nitrogen initiator, and it has a cyano group attached on the end. The cyano group is a carbon-nitrogen triple bond, and this is called azo-bis isobutyl nitrile. We pull the A, I, B, and N to make AIBN. This guy is extremely commonly used. Most of the time it's done with heat, and it only takes about 45 degrees, and this thing fragments. And the way in which it fragments is super cool. It fragments on this bond and on this bond, and it takes and pulls in an electron from each one of these. And then the remaining electron comes back, harder to draw. I'm trying to figure out how I can sneak it back in there. It's what's getting in my way, these lines that are getting in my way. So usually what we do is we pull the electron from the bond and return it to the carbon. Pull the electron from the bond and return it to the carbon, such that what we create is we create nitrogen with a triple bond. And this is just N2 gas. So that leaves the reaction vessel. And you generate two of these free radicals, which are stabilized through resonance because of the cyano group. So the cyano group has resonance with that free radical. And it's a very stable free radical. And because it has a component that eliminates itself, and you don't have to isolate anything, and it happens at such a low temperature that this is a very common free radical initiator, AIBN. You'll see it quite frequently. And I don't have the delta H for this, but it's gotta be under 100 kilojoules per mole. But I'm missing that piece of data. Okay, so these are our common initiators. And as long as we're talking about initiators, let's add some comments on inhibitors. So we know how to make free radicals. How do we kill a free radical? Number one, oxygen. Oxygen is a diradical to begin with. And because it's a diradical, it oftentimes goes and does a quench step. So let's say that we have a radical that has formed very common sort of free radical on tetrahydrofuran. It binds to oxygen, and as soon as it binds to oxygen, it kills the free radical, terminates it. It's a termination step. So oxygen in any free radical reaction shuts down the free radical reaction. If you're trying to do a free radical polymerization and oxygen gets into the reaction, it shuts down the reaction. This is why a lot of times when they're building boats and they're putting the gel coat on top of the boats, that is a free radical polymerization that makes that boat sort of surface on it, they spray it with wax to protect it from oxygen while it's curing, so that it can cure in the absence of oxygen. So there's many, many applications of this that we can see in real world applications. In a chemistry lab, we simply put an inert atmosphere over it, like nitrogen or argon, to protect it from having any oxygen in the reaction. Otherwise, it completely shuts it down. There are other sorts of molecules which will kill free radicals. Uh, hydroquinone is a very common one. Hydroquinone is a diphenol. And what happens here, I need to extend out one of these bonds. What happens here is that the radical will do the proton abstraction. And as it does the proton abstraction, this guy creates the quinone radical. And the quinone radical is actually quite stable. And it frequently then reacts in a way such that the electron pushes in, pushes over, pushes down, pushes over, pushes down, pushes over, over, and over. So we've got a cascade of electrons here that makes hydroquinone. Excuse me, not hydroquinone. This is benzoquinone. That's what I want. And so we create HR that comes out of that. And so this is a molecule that sort of is an acid-base terminator for free radicals. And then sometimes we have things like a molecule, I can't remember the name of it, BHT. This is a very common one too. BHT is a molecule that has tertiary butyl groups flanking a phenol. And when you get an R group that is a free radical that comes in and takes the proton in a proton abstraction, what you create is this BHT free radical. And because of these tertiary butyl groups, the free radical is protected and unreactive because nothing can get to it. And so the sterics here alone prevent this radical from reacting further, from allowing it to go on and do a chain reaction. BHT is actually used in food packaging. And if you look at most crackers or cereals and you read the label, it says packaging contains BHT. BHT is there to keep the cereal from getting stale, getting old.
Will you scroll up just a tad?
Yeah. And so this type of packaging that may have cereal or whatever in it contains BHT. And it prevents the cereal inside from getting stale from the reaction of oxygen reacting with the carbohydrates and things that are in the cereal. So you eliminate the free radical reaction. You prevent the spoilage of the food. It's a common application of BHT. Okay. So that was all the introductory stuff. How are we feeling? Stretch it out for a second. Shake out the cobwebs out of the brain because we've got something good coming up. Yeah, you know, a little shaky at the end in terms of these reactions and the radical inhibitors. Don't get too caught up in it because a little of this is just for reference so that you've seen it. I hearken back to it. I try to remind you about things now and then. It's not that I'm going to test you on radical inhibitors and how they work. I'm not going to test you on radical initiators and how they work. I might ask you about a free radical mechanism that includes it, and you might have to draw some mechanistic details, but I'm not going to have individual steps asking you to show me how these things work in that way. What I'm more interested in is the chemical reactions and what we can do with halogenations. So let's take a look at regioselectivity. In regioselectivity, what we're looking at is taking a molecule and halogenating it. X2, we'll do it with light. And what we find is that we get two different possible points of halogenation. We can have halogenation because there are carbons that are 1, 2, and 3. And I'll label this one 1, 2, and 3. I labeled it backwards. 1 and 3 are the same. And so if I substitute on 1 or I substitute on 3, it's identical. An example of this type of reaction would be actually doing it with chlorine and light. And we really just use a grow lamp. We take, that's the wavelength of light that is that initiates free radical reactions. It is something in the near ultraviolet range. And we take that grow lamp and we shine it on the chemical reaction and we put some tinfoil around it. And it serves as both our heat source and our light source for splitting the chlorine and initiating this reaction. And what I get is 2 chloropropane and 1 chloropropane. And I get them in a 72% and in a 28%. So clearly there is a preference for substitution at the more substituted position. And we could rationalize that and we could say, okay, well, I understand that in going through these radical mechanisms that this secondary radical is going to be more stable than a primary radical. For all the same reasons that we said with carbocations, that this guy has 2 electron donating groups on it, and the other one only has the 1 electron donating group on it. And so the intermediate, the secondary, is more stable. But the question that I would ask in order to understand what's going on here is how much more stable? Why is it so much more stable? And how much more stable is it really? And one of the ways to do that, and we don't do math very often, so excuse the math interlude here for a moment, because, let me just do it. 72%. This was for the secondary. I'm gonna scroll out a little bit so you can see it. Let's put that over 28%. That's for the primary. This has to equal the rate at which the secondary is replaced times the number of protons that are secondary protons and the number of secondary protons that I have inside of this is 2. So there are 2 hydrogens, which are secondary. And in terms of the rate of the primary being replaced, there are 6 primary protons. And so if I want to calculate out this rate and I want to figure out what the rate is, what I can do is I can cross multiply the 6H and the 2H across the other side. And I can say that 6H or 6 times, let's not get the H in there because that just confuses us. 6 times 72% over 2 times 28% is equal to the rate of the secondary divided by the rate of the primary. And now that's a number that I can equate and I can figure out these relative rates. And figuring out these relative rates, what I get is a rate that the secondary is replaced 3.9 times faster than the primary. When I work that out mathematically. So what this says is this is secondary position replaced 3.9 times faster than primary. So what I've done is I've taken in the number of hydrogens in each position and the number of times that those hydrogens can be replaced and calculated out how much faster, how much more stable that secondary is. What we're saying is that this guy is being replaced at a rate 3.9 times faster than a primary one is. Okay, so the rates for chlorination, without going through all the math and more examples to show you, relative rates. For chlorination are 1 to 3.9 to 5.2. And that is for primary, secondary, and tertiary. So what we're seeing is, as we expect, replacement at a tertiary position would be faster than a secondary, and replacement at a secondary would be faster than a primary. All right, so I didn't do a whole lot of math. I did a little bit of math. Let's look at a bromination reaction. In a bromination reaction, let's choose this substrate. We're going to brominate it, and we'll do Br2. We'll do some light. We will do a slightly elevated temperature, 60 degrees C. And what we find is that we get two main products. We get 90% out of that guy. This one is probably somewhere in the range of 8%. And there's technically one more that I see. Well, two more, I guess, that we could call. Let's put them in there. And I don't have percentages on these. These guys together are like 2%. They're like a small amount. So this is replacement at the tertiary position, the secondary position, and the combination of the primary positions. And when you run the numbers, because there's one proton to nine that are primary, or one proton to two that are secondary, when you run the relative rates for bromination, I'll save you the math. The relative rates are 1 to 82 to 1,640. This is for a primary, for which a secondary is faster, for which a tertiary is a whole lot faster. Okay, so let me just remind you that this was for bromine and that chlorine was 1 to 3.9 to 5.2. These are doing the exact same mechanism. Chlorine and bromine are almost all the same. Drew, sorry, I missed a question. Let me check and see. That is accounting for all of the hydrogens that are bonded to the primary carbons. Yes, that is correct. And all of the hydrogens attached to the secondary carbons. And that is correct. So yes, those questions, those are correct assumptions. My question is, chlorine and bromine are so similar. What is changing in this chemical reaction that is making bromine 1,640 times more selective for a tertiary position over chlorine, which is only 5.2 times more selective for a tertiary position? And you can't answer that until I show you the reason. So the reason is it has to do with the chlorine bond and the bromine bond, that when you look at the chlorine bond and the bromine bond, that the initiation step, the chlorine abstracting a proton versus the bromine abstracting a proton. So the difference happens in this step. Let's take and...
Jason, is it abstracting a proton or a hydrogen?
Proton and a hydrogen are the same thing. I use that word interchangeably.
Okay, that's good.
So, I mean, when we think proton, we think positive charge. When we think hydrogen, we think the hydrogen connected to the carbon. But I use the term proton and hydrogen interchangeably. I will refer to this guy on the carbon as a proton just as much as I will refer to an H plus ion. It's probably not as accurate as I should be, but it's very common for organic chemists to refer to protons as hydrogens on a carbon molecule.
Are you starting to draw an energy diagram?
I am. Who asked that? Mary?
Mary, yeah.
I am starting to draw an energy diagram. Yes, I am indeed. Oops, that's my eraser though. So, I'm gonna let my energy diagram sort of click in here. What we're looking at is that when we have the chlorine free radical and we have the carbon, and then we have the Cl pulling that proton. So this is the transition state that's happening up here. And then we get to the ClH and the R free radical. Before we move on to the next step, which would be going down to even a more stable product over here. As I move down. So this is chlorination and what the chlorination looks like. How far did I go? In bromination, bromination looks like this. And then there's a step here. It looks like this. And so we have the Br free radical and the HR, and then the intermediate where I'm pulling the proton, actually transition state, I used the wrong word, I apologize. And then down here we get BRH and the R radical. And then that radical is reacting with another bromine, so I'm getting BR bound to the R and BRH. And down here I'm getting Cl bound to the carbon and HCl. And my rate determining step is my highest activation energy step. So this is my rate determining step. Now, because of the because of the stability of the bromine free radical versus the stability of the carbon free radical, this step is endothermic. And because it's endothermic, it changes the nature of the transition state, as opposed to the chlorine, where the chlorine is not as stable with the free radical, and the carbon free radical is more stable than the chlorine free radical. So this one is exothermic. So the differences are here in this reaction, I'm exothermic in this rate determining step. And in the other one with the bromination, I'm endothermic. Okay, remember Hammond postulate? Did I not speak about Hammond postulate at length earlier? And we talked about how the transition state resembles the side of the reaction mechanism that it is closest in energy to, which means that the transition state for the chlorine reaction resembles the chlorine free radical. So by Hammond postulate, what I'm looking at is Hammond says these two sides of the equation are linked. And Hammond postulate for the bromine says that these two sides are linked. Okay, so follow with me now for a second. Where is the carbon-free radical that I am interested in, the stability of the carbon-free radical? The carbon-free radical resides right here. And right there. As the carbon-free radical gets more stable, as the carbon-free radical goes to a tertiary carbon-free radical, As the tertiary, or if we look at a tertiary free radical, it would lower down the energy for this. And as I look at a primary free radical. And actually, I guess I got to get the free radical out of there. I just need to do tertiary and primary because otherwise it's confusing. And really, I should only do one set of arrows because that's also confusing. So this will be primary and this will be tertiary. Because the stability of the free radical over here is not linked to the transition state, it has very little influence over the transition state. And because it has very little influence, the rates are very similar and unchanging for this chemical reaction. So the rates were 1 to 3.9 to 5.2. And those rates are so similar because stability of the free radical has no influence on the activation energy of the reaction. So stability of the free radical has little influence on the transition state and on the activation of the reaction, making all of the substitutions fairly similar. However, over on the other side, the picture is very different. If I increase the energy here by going to a primary free radical, that has huge implications for my transition state because they are linked by Hammond postulate. That will increase the energy of the reaction, slowing it down dramatically. If I make the free radical more favorable, such as a tertiary, it will lower this activation energy substantially, making the reaction run much faster. And that reaction is controlled by that transition state. And so I end up with those numbers of 1 for the primary and 1640 for the tertiary. Because the free radical structure is linked directly to the transition state through Hammond postulate. And it's simply the difference of endothermic versus exothermic in the step. When you switch it to endothermic and your product has control over your transition state, you get much greater regioselectivity. That's what's happening here. So here, critically, the stability of the free radical is directly linked to the stability of the transition state. And the activation of the reaction. And so it has a bigger influence. Whoa, sorry, scanning. So that's where all that regioselectivity comes from. The regioselectivity comes from the change in switching over from something that is exothermic to something that is endothermic. And a direct application of Hammond postulate and control over the transition state that governs the reaction. Okay, Keegan, why is one exo and the other endo? One is exo and one is endo. We could do it two ways, Keegan. One way is to look at the bond association energies for HCl and HBr and can compare them with the pulling of the proton from the hydrocarbon. And I have those numbers and I can show you those numbers, that there's a net difference in those numbers. But we could also explain it in simply the size, that chlorine being small cannot delocalize that radical very well. And so is less stable with the radical being higher in energy. The carbon has much better chances of stabilizing the free radical because of the electron donating capability of those things that are around the carbon molecule. On the other hand, bromide is very happy with this free radical because it's so large and polarizable that it's perfectly stable with that free radical. And yet, when I give the free radical to the carbon doesn't have that size that the bromine does, right? Bromine is two periods below carbon in the periodic table. It's massive compared to carbon. And so carbon is less stable with the free radical than bromine was, changing the interaction and making it an endothermic reaction at that point. So Sterling, the enthalpy of formation for the chloro transition state is exothermic, whereas the entropy a formation for the bromo transition state is endothermic, which is, I believe, correct. Would the size of the R group make much difference? Not very much, Keegan, because, yes, the size of the R group makes a little bit of difference, but not a whole lot. And particularly, it makes almost no difference in terms of the chlorine reaction. It makes a bigger difference in terms of the bromine reaction. And so what we'll see is that because of these things, we tend to look more at brominations than we do at chlorinations, because the net outcome all of this is bromination is more selective than chlorination. And so we choose to do bromination because it's way more selective and we can control it better. And that's the outcome out of all of this. So from here on out, mostly, we will mostly focus on brominations because they are more selective. And when I say selectivity, what I mean is regioselectivity. that we're substituting primary, less than secondary, and a whole lot less than tertiary. All right, so I'm out of time. What I will remind you though, and I'm gonna plant the seed really quick, so listen carefully. What we just focused on was induction. What is a bigger stabilizing force than induction?
Resonance.
Resonance. We have resonance to look at yet. And while we have looked at the selectivity of what we see in terms of induction, that don't always go for the tertiary position. If there's resonance someplace else, the resonance is going to win out over the induction. And so sometimes you can get substitution at secondaries or even primary positions because of resonance instead of the tertiary position. So be aware of that. I'm planting the seed. I'm letting you know. Okay. I'm going to put some exercises up online for you guys to do. I'll put them in Canvas and I'll put them in some other places and I'll email out a link so you know where to go and what to do. That'll give you some practice. Not for this yet, just yet. I'm going to keep the practice going for the alkyne chapter. You guys are going to be working your practice a little bit behind of where we are in lecture. So I'll send out some good practice problems to do. And I'll make sure that SI has them as well. I think I've already given them to your SI leader. So you'll be picking up with those. And yeah, we're doing good work. Okay. I'll hang out on the line if anybody has any questions. Other than that, I'm going to turn off the recording. And thanks for a good lecture. Thanks for hanging in there with me, guys.
I had a quick question.
Go for it.
So someone tried to help me in chat, and I think I maybe get it, but I want to make sure.
Sure.
When you're counting like the secondary hydrogens and the primary hydrogens for the rate, is it like the hydrogens that are directly attached to the secondary position in question and then the primary position in question?
Yeah, so when we're, if we're taking a look at a molecule and we choose to look at here, I would say that all of the primary would be sort of equivalent and that you're not gonna get a whole lot of differences in these primary. There's some steric differences, but they're not great. So I would say that there are 9 that are primary. There is 2 that are secondary. And there's only 1 in this case, which is tertiary. And so, yeah, I was sort of looking at them in aggregate and counting them up in the different positions.
Okay, that clears that up. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah, Drew.
Could I ask you a question? I have one question regarding the quiz. I had one little thing I got hung up on. I want to see if you can maybe point me in the right direction or give me a little hint maybe, but sure. I was working on 1 and I was kind of getting stuck in breaking up the epoxide and moving to the alkyne, adding 2 carbons in that process as well.
Okay. Moving from the epoxide, and it was an alkyne that was reacting with the epoxide, and it was, had to be.
I think we end up in an alkyne. So it goes from the epoxide to creating an alkyne. And then also in that one step, there's 2 carbons added to the structure.
Let me, hang on 1 second.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I want to, I've been doing so many things and so much other work. I want to remember what I'm looking at.
I don't know if I'm remotely right, but what I did is I looked at the sodium amide and maybe adding like just carbons triple bonded to each other. And that seemed to work for me, maybe.
Yeah, my guess is I was first trying to add like 2 equivalents of sodium amide. And then I kind of got hung up from there because I know that would break up the epoxide and kind of start to help form the alkyne.
Now I'm understanding what the questions are. Okay, so both of you, thank you. That was helpful. What was intended there is that you were given a product that was clearly the, and there's a counter ion here that I included in it, that there's a, if we count the number of atoms and look at where things are, this is 1, 2, 3, and 4, 1, 2, 3, and 4. So the oxygen stays connected on 3. There is a new bond that has been generated. So this is the new bond. And then there are 2 new carbons, the alkyne, that have been added. And so critically, we added 2 carbons. To do that, all you really need to do is just bring in the anion. You don't need to create it. So you don't need to include reagents such as sodium or sodium amide or any of those things to create this. This can be a reagent that you can just drop in anytime you want to use it. So if I want to make an alkynyl anion and I'm not being told I have to make it, I'm just being told what reagent could I use to do this job. This is the reagent that would come and would strike carbon number 4 because that's your least sterically hindered. This one is secondary, this one is primary. It's inherently an SN2 reaction. This bond breaks open and we achieve the structure on the right-hand side. So the same thing could be said, let's say that I gave you, just to solidify this concept, let's say that I gave you an epoxide that had nothing else attached to it. And what I wanted you to create was I wanted you to create this thing that had that there, then the only thing that you would need to do is to be able to look and say, this is 1 and 2, 1 and 2, starting from where my oxygen is. That makes this piece my new bond that's here. And then everything that comes after that is my carbon nucleophile, and I simply draw that and put a negative charge on it and give it a counter ion. And the counter ion could be either sodium or lithium. And away you go.
Okay, that clarifies it a lot. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anytime. All right, anybody got anything else?
Can you mess with that induction just by, like, let's say you had an R group that had a bunch of halogens on it, like 3 fluorines.
Yeah.
And it pulled the electron density away from like a tertiary or secondary.
Yes.
Position. Would it favor the prime then?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
That was it. I was just wondering.
That is how organic chemists think. Yes, that's what we do. We mess with it. We put electron withdrawing groups on it and electron donating groups on it. And then we see how far we can push Mother Nature in the other direction. And yes, that's absolutely. We would take and we would put trifluoro groups on it, and because they're less reactive to the free radical reactions. And we would look to see, can we influence, if we put enough trifluoro groups around a tertiary, can we push the selectivity to go towards the secondary? And the answer to that question is absolutely, because it's not about the substitution. It's about how stable the free radical is. And so if you make that free radical less stable than the secondary, then it will go towards the secondary. Spot on.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Pokey, you got a question? Okay, take care.